In the last lecture, we saw England achieve unparalleled military victories over the French in the War of the Spanish Succession, but no peace. Rather, the Marlborough-Godolphin ministry, now fully dominated by the Whigs, proved itself incapable of stopping the war, probably because its traditional francophobia blinded its leaders to the fact that Louis XIV was effectively finished by 1710. The Whig ministry had also managed to offend the country in the area of religion by the Sacheverell prosecution, and to offend the Queen on the issue of sovereignty. Queen Anne reacted by first undermining her own ministry, then dismissing them in the summer of 1710. This lecture portrays the rise of the new ministry under Robert Harley, to be named Earl of Oxford from 1711, and its attempts to solve the problems of peace, religion, and the succession. The lecture concludes with Oxford's fall over the last issue, the final illness and death of the Queen, and the peaceful accession of the Hanoverian as George I. In the late summer of 1710, Queen Anne and her new first minister, Robert Harley, dismissed the Whig Parliament, called a general election, and went to the country with a promise of peace. The result was a Tory landslide. This gave the Queen and her minister a mandate to end the war. Nevertheless, the peace negotiations took 2.5 years. They were opposed by the Whigs, who continued to fear Louis XIV, and to demand, in the face of military reality and the wishes of the majority of the Spanish people, that the Bourbons be denied the Spanish throne. The peace was also opposed by most of the Allies, who feared that Harley would secure concessions for Britain at their expense. To secure their ends, all sides, the Tories, the Whigs, Britain, and her allies, resorted to some very shady dealing. For example, in December 1711, the Whigs tried to buy Tory votes on the peace by promising to support a bill against occasional conformity. Now, note, in doing this, they're attacking their own dissenting constituency. They're selling the dissenters up the river. But they're so desperate because they're so fearful of Louis XIV. In return, a group of dissident Tories, led by the Earl of Nottingham, who's been shut out of the ministry, supported a motion in the House of Lords, no peace without Spain. We'll sign no peace unless we get Spain for the Habsburgs. The motion passed. That threatened to wreck the peace process before the start of formal negotiations. But Anne had a trick up her sleeve. She responded a few days later by using her prerogative powers to create 12 new Tory peers in the House of Lords. She just packed the Lords with people that she knew would vote for the peace. This tactic provided the votes necessary for the peace to go forward. The Whigs charged that Anne had violated the spirit of the post-1688 Constitution by pushing her prerogative powers to their limits. So much of the English Constitution is good behavior and bad behavior. Clearly, Queen Anne would do anything to secure a peace. The Allies, too, did their best to wreck the negotiations, often in concert with the Whigs. They would be writing to various people. They'd pass notes to various diplomats. In return, Harley, named Earl of Oxford in 1711, actually conducted secret negotiations preliminary to the real ones. All the details were worked out before the peace conference at Utrecht began. As this came out, it led the Allies to charge that they were being left in the lurch by perfidious Albion. Finally, to sweeten the deal for Louis XIV and to make sure that nothing went wrong, remember, in these negotiations, they're trying to figure out where the borders are all going to be. The last thing they need is for Marlborough to go on a rampage and launch an invasion of France. And so the Duke of Marlborough was dismissed in December 1711. Then, unbeknownst to the Allies, Queen Anne issued secret restraining orders to his replacement, the Duke of Ormond. It is therefore little wonder that the Treaty of Utrecht of 1713 and the later Treaty of Rastatt, negotiated by the Holy Roman Emperor in 1714, seemed to both Whigs and the Allies to be a sellout. The Duke of Anjou remained on the throne of Spain as Felipe V, albeit with a promise that the crowns of Spain and France would never again be worn by the same person. But didn't we see this promise before? The Allies received territory, but not nearly as much as Marlborough and Eugene's victories had led them to expect. The Dutch got a series of barrier forts on the southern border. Their guns now faced France. These were French forts that now go over to the Dutch, and the guns are turned around. The Holy Roman Emperor received territory in Italy, as well as the Spanish Netherlands, roughly the equivalent of modern-day Belgium. So there's actually a buffer zone between the Netherlands, the Dutch Republic, and the French. Savoy claimed Sicily. Britain got some territory and other concessions. There was Gibraltar and Minorca in the Mediterranean, Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and Hudson's Bay in Canada, St. Kitts in the Caribbean, the asiento, that is, the right to sell African slaves to the Spanish New World, plus trading rights with the Spanish Empire, and finally, the promise of recognition of the Hanoverian succession by Louis XIV. The Whigs, hoping for a Habsburg Spain and huge swaths of French territory, or maybe Canada, thought these paltry acquisitions after the expenditure of so much blood and treasure. As for Louis's promises that the crowns of Spain and France would never be united, well, they'd seen Louis's promises before. There was also his promise to abandon the pretender and recognize the Hanoverian succession. They didn't believe that one either. In the next reign, they would impeach the Earl of Oxford for squandering Marlborough's victories. But they shouldn't have done, for the Treaty of Utrecht was in fact a masterstroke of diplomacy. It confirmed and completed the work of the Revolution of 1688-89, and it ensured British superiority in Europe for a generation and beyond. First, the settlement in Spain could not have been otherwise. The majority of the Spanish people wanted the Bourbon candidate. The Allies had lost the Iberian Peninsula in the defeats at Almanza and Brihuega. The military situation was irretrievable. The Allied candidate for the Spanish throne, Carlos III, had in the meantime succeeded as Holy Roman Emperor. You see, his elder brother, the Emperor Joseph, had died unexpectedly in 1711, which means that he was the Holy Roman Emperor, which means that if the Whigs had got their way, they would have replaced a massive Bourbon empire with a massive Habsburg one. They would, in fact, have recreated the empire of Charles V. In fact, it didn't matter who sat on the throne of Spain, for both Spain and France were exhausted financially and militarily after so many years of warfare. Oxford was smart enough to see that. He knew that. Louis XIV would never again challenge the peace of Europe or pose a threat to the Hanoverian succession. He would expel James from his dominions. In 1715, the Sun King would die, confessing on his deathbed that he had, perhaps, been too much in love with war. Because Louis had outlived his son and his grandson, and apart from Philippe, because France had no choice but to obey the terms of Utrecht, Louis XIV would be succeeded by his five-year-old great-grandson, Louis XV. Well, this little kid, combined with France's prostrate finances, means that England's ancient enemy would be in no shape to fight a major European war again for at least a generation. In the meantime, Britain's territorial acquisitions sealed its status as the wealthiest trading nation on earth. Gibraltar. That's all Harley wanted. Gibraltar. A little rock at the end, the western end of the Mediterranean, which, of course, ensures strategic control of the whole Mediterranean area. If you have ever seen the war film Das Boot, you'll remember a German U-boat trying to get into the Mediterranean during World War II being blocked at Gibraltar. He couldn't touch the British because of the importance, strategic importance of Gibraltar. The Canadian territories may have been bleak and remote. This is not maybe the parts of Canada you'd go for immediately, but they provided furs and Grand Banks fish to clothe and feed Europe and more than a foothold in Canada. Britain's Caribbean possessions and dominance of the slave trade ensured control of the notorious triangular trade in slaves, tobacco, and sugar from the New World. See, Oxford has a ruthless streak. The sugar trade, in particular, would prove the most valuable trade in the world in the 18th century. Sugar was the oil of its day. Britain had also finally won entrance into the Spanish trading system. Remember what Hawkins and Drake had fought for? Well, now the British can finally trade with the Spanish colonies. Now, there are obviously deep moral implications to what has just been worked out here. I am going to discuss that. I want to save it for a subsequent lecture. For the moment, I want to concentrate on what this does for Britain materially. As a result of these new commercial arrangements, the British would be the wealthiest and most powerful nation in Europe. British trade produced money, which produced military superiority, which produced victories, which produced colonies, which produced more trade. In other words, the commercial revolution begat the financial revolution, which begat the victory at Blenheim, which begat the Treaty of Utrecht, which begat an empire, which begat more commerce, and so on and so on. It's a cycle that will grow and grow and grow and make Britain more powerful. Eventually, the profit from that process would be invested in more wars. The War of the Austrian Succession, 1742-48. The Seven Years' War, 1756-63. The American Revolutionary War, 1775-83. The French Revolutionary Wars, 1793-1801. The Napoleonic Wars, 1803-1815. Only one of which would be an unequivocal French victory. These profits would also be poured into the Industrial Revolution, thus further extending Britain's economic lead. So the British system of government and war finance, what Professor John Brewer calls the sinews of power, explains why Britain won most of its wars with France, culminating on the field of Waterloo in 1815. Why Britain replaced France as the most powerful country in Europe. Why Britain built a world-encircling empire in the 18th century. Why Britain became the first industrial nation and the richest country on earth for most of not only the 18th, but also the 19th centuries. Now, at this point, American listeners are saying, but wait a minute, they lost a good bit of that empire during the American Revolutionary War. Well, let me take a minute, advance about 50 years, and talk about that. One way to think of this, rather different from the way it's taught in American history books, is, do you realize that this was the only war in which the French had our help? In fact, the loss of America would be psychologically devastating to the English, there's no question. It led to a reform movement in the 1780s, but it would also be an economic and military blessing. The British no longer had to pay for our defense, but they continued to trade with America. After beating the French for good in 1815, the British would go on to extend their empire in the 19th century. So, as I promised in the first lecture, the fate of England under the Tudors and the Stuarts goes far to explain the fate of the world in the course of the next two centuries. The French never figured this out. They never figured out the connections among war, trade, finance, and empire, which explains why they lost six of seven 18th century wars against Britain and became a second-rate power in the 19th century. Put another way, while the French were entering a period of decline, the British were going from strength to strength. This reminds me of a story, perhaps my favorite story in all of Western civilization, related by Samuel Johnson in his Lives of the Poets, which I think sums up the last few lectures, what we've been talking about, and this whole experience between Britain and France. Now, to understand the story, you have to remember how Louis financed his wars. He taxed his peasants until they bled dry. Remember that William and Anne had managed to find a way to finance their wars by drawing on and increasing the commercial wealth of the country. Remember, too, that Louis had also plowed his peasants' money into the magnificent palace of Versailles. While William and Anne never built a great palace, they poured all of their resources into fighting and winning these wars. After Whitehall Palace burns down in 1698, William and Anne live in St. James's Palace, which is tiny and cramped. If you go to London, that'll be obvious. Anyway, here's the story. Back at the end of the 9 Years' War, William III had sent Matthew Prior to France to negotiate that partition treaty with Louis XIV. The French diplomats were anxious to overawe Prior with French power. Now, in our day, they would have shown him their missiles. They didn't have missiles. They had Versailles. So there they are, tromping Prior around Versailles, hoping that he'll be impressed. The French knew full well that the British monarch could not exploit his people in the way Louis XIV had done because there was Parliament to stop him. They knew further that the British monarch had spent all of his money on fighting their master and that he had no palace of the size and magnificence of Versailles. So at the end of the tour, they turned to Prior and they asked him what he thought of their master's house, probably with an air of superiority. And Prior turns to them and replies, "The monuments of my master's actions are to be seen everywhere but in his own house." The British crown had found a way to fight the French and enrich its people in the process. Louis had only brought his people poverty and misery. Now, of course, what Pryor didn't say was that some of the monuments of his master's and subsequent master's actions, such as the Irish Penal Code, or later the Asiento and slave trade, were cruel and shameful. But I will make an argument in Lecture 48 that ultimately the commercial, the financial, and the glorious revolutions also begat the tools of democracy, which would eventually be used by these very oppressed peoples to secure freedom from their British masters. So I can still kind of, on this one, I think, have a bit of my cake and eat it too, and argue that because of these developments, the British developed ideals and a system of government which these oppressed peoples would hold up as a mirror to the British and say, this is shameful, you must change it. While the French system of absolute monarchy begat the turmoil of the French Revolution. This is the ultimate legacy of the Glorious Revolution and the Peace of Utrecht. Now, to get back to Queen Anne and Robert Harley. Anne had appointed Robert Harley her first minister in 1710, named him Earl of Oxford in 1711, and Lord Treasurer, not just to secure a peace, but also to save her from the five tyrannizing lords of the Whig Junto. That is, she expected him to maintain a coalition ministry. Remember, that's why she wasn't happy with the Whigs. There were two problems with this. First, the parliamentary elections of 1710 and 1713 were Tory landslides. That made it very difficult to prevent that party, led by Henry St. John, Viscount Bolingbroke at this point, from simply hijacking the ministry. We control the votes in Parliament. You got to appoint us. And so Bolingbroke and the Tories pressured Oxford to follow their party line and appoint more Tories. This was a problem for Oxford because to keep the Queen happy, he's got to hang on to Whigs. The second reason that proved to be impossible was that the political nation was still torn over the great issues of the day, namely the peace, as we've seen. The Whigs wouldn't let this rest. They would impeach Oxford in the next reign. Religion and the succession. The Whigs fought Oxford on all three issues. So you have a situation in which the Earl of Oxford is walking a tightrope. He's my last tightrope walker in this course. I've used that metaphor a little bit too much. On the one hand, he has to please the Tory majority with Tory appointments and Tory policies. But he has to please the Queen by hanging on to some Whigs in spite of his Tory appointments and Tory policies. As we've seen, Oxford walked that tightrope quite successfully on the issue of war and peace, but he would fall off because of religion and the succession. In the area of religion, the Tories sought to roll back the toleration, drive dissenters, and therefore Whigs, out of public life, and restore the monopoly of the Church of England. Now, early in her reign, Anne would have agreed with this, but by 1710, 11, 12, both Anne and Oxford realized this is needlessly divisive. It was especially difficult for Oxford because, as you may remember, he began life as a dissenter. He came from a dissenting background. But both recognized that they had to give the Tories their head on religion as the price to secure the peace. They had to please the Tories on religion to have the votes to win the peace. And so in 1711, Anne and Oxford agreed to build 50 London churches. Well, that's pretty painless. To ban occasional conformity. And far more seriously, in 1714, they agreed to the Schism Act, which forbade dissenters from teaching or keeping schools. The idea, as with the Clarendon Code, was to cut dissent off at the root and out of public life. Because so many dissenters were Whigs, this would have had the additional advantage from the Tory point of view of weakening that party. Not surprisingly, nearly every Whig had resigned office by 1714. Oxford was failing the Queen in his attempt to maintain a moderate ministry. But it was the succession, as well as perhaps the immense pressure he bore, which brought Oxford down. Queen Anne, the succession was always an issue because, remember, Queen Anne had been in poor health for most of her reign. Remember, she had to literally be carried to her coronation, though she was able to stand and walk at other times. By 1710, she was almost entirely lame and frequently indisposed by gout. In the winter of 1713-14, Anne almost died, experiencing fever and intermittent consciousness. This focused everyone's attention on the succession and the next reign. Now, of course, I think you know the positions. The Whigs supported the Hanoverian accession, as laid out in the Act of Settlement, unequivocally. No problem. They were in close contact with the Electress Sophia, and after she died in May 1714, with her son and successor, the Elector Georg Ludwig. But they controlled neither the court, and you know, that's very nice that they're corresponding with him, but remember, the Whigs are in the minority in Parliament, and they don't have any offices left at court. It's the Tories who matter right now. The Tories who were in office were split between a Hanoverian wing and a Jacobite wing. The latter still hoped that on her deathbed, Anne would restore her half-brother, the Pretender. Because the Tories are the largest group in the Commons, Oxford has to try to keep them together to support his ministry. He has to try to convince both groups, both Hanoverians and Jacobites, that he's on their side. Indeed, Oxford may have been tempted to play kingmaker. I mean, think about it. If he can bestow the crown on the next king of England, he'll be set for life, right? So he begins to negotiate with both men. Of course, Georg, you know I'm a Hanoverian. Don't worry about a thing. He writes off to James, wondering if James might consider a public conversion to the Church of England. You know, wouldn't affect your private beliefs, but just for, you know, show. He also made conflicting promises to supporters of both men. Now, to further confuse the issue, and this has made historians' lives all the more difficult, during this same period that he's speaking out of both sides of his mouth, the pressure of maintaining this delicate balancing act clearly began to wear on Oxford. He drank heavily. He missed appointments. When he did see the Queen, he was increasingly incoherent and evasive. Now, that may have been his declining capacity, but you should know that Oxford had always been a master of intrigue. Remember Oxford going up the back stairs? His nickname was the Backstairs Dragon, because he was so adept at using secret methods and access at court. So some politicians, you know, they'd listen to him and he'd make no sense, and they'd say, ah, that's Oxford, he's so smart, he's trying to be all things to all men. But the Queen would have none of this. Oxford's diminished capacity and Anne's increased self-possession are demonstrated, I think, in an incident from the fall of 1713. Anne had promised the office of Treasurer of the Chamber to John West, Lord Delaware. Now, there's some evidence to believe that Oxford wanted to give the place to someone else. Giving offices is one of the ways you hang on to people's loyalty. Maybe he was just losing it by this time. In any case, Oxford submitted to the Queen a blank warrant. That is, a warrant that was all made out except for the name of the recipient of the office. This is like a blank check, right? Anne's reaction, as conveyed in a letter dated 21st October, reveals in no uncertain terms that she was not to be trifled with. I was very much surprised to find by your letter that though I had told you the last time you were here, I intended to give the Treasurer of the Chamber to Lord Delaware, you will bring me a warrant in blank. I desire you would not have so ill an opinion of me as to think when I have determined anything in my mind, I will alter it. I have told Lord Delaware I will give him this office, and he has kissed my hand upon it. Therefore, when you come hither, bring the warrant with his name. Whatever happened to that fraidy cat that Sarah, Duchess of Marlborough, liked to describe? Clearly, by the end of her life, Queen Anne had learned to use the language of her birth and the prerogative of her position to get what she wanted. So imagine her reaction when, in the summer of 1714, she discovers Oxford's double game with the Elector and the Pretender. Now, you should know that she's been writing to the Elector saying, I'm a Hanoverian, you have nothing to worry about, leave me alone. After an emotional meeting on the 27th of July at Kensington Palace, Anne demanded Oxford's resignation as Lord Treasurer. The way you're appointed Lord Treasurer is you're handed a staff. There's no warrant. There's no place where your name is written down. Anne demanded the staff. That night, the Queen was overheard through the bedchamber door to be weeping. What was she crying about? I've always wondered. Maybe she was weeping over her lost friendship with Oxford. He's the last one of the circle of friends with which she began the reign. Maybe she was weeping for the end of her dreams of moderation, and thus for royal initiative. You see, Oxford was the last politician who had any hope of maintaining that balance between Whigs and Tories. With Oxford gone, Anne is going to have to choose one party or the other. With Oxford gone, she's going to have to be a completely constitutional monarch and either let the Whigs run the show or let the Tories run the show. Now, in fact, as fate would have it, she never had to make the decision. On the morning of the 30th of July, she apparently suffered a stroke while standing in the long gallery at Kensington. You can go and you yourself can stand at the mantel where Anne stood. Desperately ill, she began to sink into a coma. The Queen's ladies of the bedchamber, the Duchesses of Somerset and Ormond, one Whig, one Tory, immediately spread the word. They tell their husbands, get here now, get to the palace. Hanoverian Whigs, Hanoverian Tories, Jacobite Tories, they all flock to Kensington. In a sense, the entire reign, the future of the revolution settlement, the fate of Europe, and this entire lecture course comes down to what would happen now at Kensington. Who would seize power? Who would be Anne's new Lord Treasurer? And who would he proclaim as the next King of England? That afternoon, the Queen's Privy Councillors met at Kensington, and they advised her to name as her new Lord Treasurer the Duke of Shrewsbury. Now, Shrewsbury was a consensus candidate. He was a Whig, but he'd stayed on in the Oxford ministry. He was well thought of by the Tories. And he was one of the immortal seven who'd invited William of Orange to invade in 1688. You may remember his name. In other words, his revolutionary credentials were impeccable, which of course meant the Hanoverian succession. Now remember, there's Jacobites at the meeting, Jacobite peers. There's no record that any one of them piped up and said, well, what about James? It would, of course, have been treason to do so. But here was their chance, and they lost their nerve. Anne accepted the recommendation of her Privy Council, and her hand guided by one of her officials, she handed the staff to Shrewsbury. According to one version, she did so with the words, use it for the good of my people. It's apocryphal. It's probable that she didn't say that. It's probable she wasn't in shape to say it. But it's believable. Anne had always operated on that principle. Anne's last act ensured the Hanoverian succession. Anne, by the grace of God, Queen of Great Britain and Ireland, defender of the faith, the last Stuart ruler of the British Isles, died at 7:45 a.m. on the 1st of August, 1714. Georg Ludwig, Elector of Hanover, was duly proclaimed King George that afternoon. A new political world had dawned. Or had it? A contemporary might have been forgiven for wondering if this really was such a great milestone. Once again, I'd like you to imagine a woman. Maybe the great-granddaughter of the woman I introduced you to in Lecture 20. She's born around 1630 under the government of King Charles I and the Anglican religious ascendancy. Imagine that she still lives in 1714, having grown to the ripe old age of 84. It was possible, some people did. As a child, she might have heard her parents and her grandparents, if hers were among the few living grandparents, talk about the Armada and the Gunpowder Plot and political and religious strife under Queen Elizabeth and King James. She would almost certainly have heard her parents complain about the hard economic times. In the 1640s, while she was a teenager, her father and brothers might have gone off to fight the civil wars. At the end of the decade, she would have witnessed the disestablishment of the national church and the execution of her king, Anne's grandfather. In her 20s, during the 1650s, she would have been ruled by a series of unstable governments and exposed to a wide variety of weird political and religious ideas. In 1660, at the age of 30, maybe she went off to a Quaker meeting, you don't know. She would have seen the restoration of the Stuart monarchy and the Church of England, but thereafter, during her middle age, heard of unsuccessful foreign wars, domestic plots, and increasing tension between king and parliament over money and religion. Then, in 1688, at the end of her 50s, she would have lived through a second revolution in church and state. This would be followed by, in her old age, by 2 decades of almost continuous warfare abroad and bitter party strife at home. Now, at the end of her life, she's to be ruled by a new foreign king. Had she been a betting woman, would she have wagered that he and his advisors could bring England peace, stability, and prosperity? In fact, Had she taken that bet, she would have won. For that is precisely what King George I and his advisors managed to accomplish. That is the story of the next lecture.